Okay, so I'm talking today on the GRB supernova and the supernova GRB link. I'll mainly talk of supernova associated GRBs. Alicia Soderberg will tell us a lot about the other way around, supernovae that may be associated with GRBs in the local sample. Okay. I thought I'd start off with a summary in case those who start pretty early in the morning, you want to catch up. You just have to listen to this one slide, and then I'll wake you up when I finish up. So, okay, long-duration GRBs, I would say, have associated supernovae. That is, whenever an attempt has been made and the conditions are favorable, a supernova has been found or the limits are interesting. In the best studied case, which means spectroscopic studies, the type of the supernova is a 1C. However, there's a difference of 5 magnitude spread in the peak magnitude of these associated supernovae. So I'd like to first right away tell you the idea that all the supernovae are hypernova, absolutely luminous things. At least if you want to remember one thing from this talk, you should remember that's not true at all, despite the advertisement. Going to the nearby sample, that is, if you look the other way around, so here the first part is where you look at GRB, then you go and see if there's a supernova. How about the other way? You look at a supernova and then see if there's some sign of a GRB, or maybe there was a GRB that took off in a catalog, or is something interesting going on, like an afterglow, which would mean a GRB perhaps, but not pointed to you. In all these years, which is now, what, roughly 8 years, there's been only one supernova, 98BW, which is interesting. So if there are some mysterious GRBs that are like this laser beam directed away from you, they're being very mysterious and continue to be mysterious. okay. When you look at any of these things, supernovae here and associated GRBs, there's a diversity in the energy channels, by which I mean there are many ways by which energy is coming out of these explosions. Gamma rays, which trace high Lorentz factor ejecta. Early afterglow, by which, like, I mean a day, X-ray optical, which is Lorentz factors of 10 or tens. And late afterglow, which I mean a week, mainly in the radio, Lorentz factor of a few. And finally, the one with the least velocity, which is the supernova itself. So these are very different energy channels. And as you can well imagine, or you may wish to know, it's a dirty game. Some are heavy in gamma rays, some have powerful supernovae, some have powerful afterglow, and so on. Okay, in almost all cases, given the connection between, you know, massive stars and supernovae and core collapse, you would expect to see evidence for stellar wind, ambient medium. In almost most cases, there's in fact no evidence. In fact, the number of events where you can actually trace and say, oh yeah, there is a r to the minus 2 density profile is handful, literally, a few. Okay, so this game, I would say, starts off with 98BW, which was in the error localization of the GRB 980425, found by Galama and collaborators. The supernova, usually many of the modelers talk a lot about the optical data, and I'm not being very parochial, but actually there's something very distinctive about this in the radio more than anything else. And so I thought I'd highlight the facility which did the radio discovery in Australia. So the optical data has been modeled by a number of groups and compared with other supernovae like 94I, which is a 1C, 97EF, and this is an absolute magnitude. And you can see BW is bright, a bit over minus 19.5, and it has a usual bump and an exponential decline, as you see in other sort of type 1 supernovae. And this has been modeled, and I think there's general agreement that the energy in the explosion is 10 times that in a typical supernova, that is 10^4 or 10 to the 52 ergs. If you then worry in detail whether this explosion was symmetrical or not, you can get some answers which are larger. But I think the idea that this is energetic because the velocities were large, I think, is generally accepted. As it turns out, the one thing that still remains unique about this supernova is while the optical stuff, which is what I described so far, is what's called as broad line. These are fairly broad lines, fast-moving lines you see at early times. In the radio, you can infer that from the strong radio afterglow, essentially, that there is a Lorentz factor of a few ejecta even 4 days after the burst with energy of the order of 10 to 50 ergs. So in this particular case, it's an interesting situation where the gamma rays is the least of the energy channels. Even the isotropic value, because we don't know what is the geometry of this, the isotropic value is at the most 10 to the 48 ergs. The radio is over 10 to the 50, by which I mean Lorentz factor of few, and then the optical explosion is 10 to the 52. So it's got a certain scale here, which makes it still very unique. Okay, so what's so special about this supernova that we still remember it today? Well, it's a type 1c supernova. There are dime a dozen of those. It's not so special. 94i is a type 1c and nothing special about it. Broad lines, that was sort of the initial thing. There are other supernovae of the 1c which also have broad lines. And then you can start making some distinction. Well, it didn't have the same breadth on day 3.5 as this other one. But at the sort of level that I look at, which is roughly, you know, zeroth order, no, it doesn't seem like a particularly distinguishing feature. Bright supernovae, there are supernovae brighter than this, and they don't seem to do anything else. And the reason I stress the radio emission, which is just an observational approach, but the real value is here, this Lorentz factor is a few. And the reason it's important is if you just take a compact star, like a progenitor for 1C, and you say, oh, I'm going to now explode this star, how much of what is the highest speed I can get as a shock wave races down? You will never get a gamma of 2. And this is something that it's a very delicate numerical problem, as I understand. The people have worked, Masson, Tan, McKee, and others. And to get this gamma of 2, you really need a very strong explosion. Okay, and in fact, it is not seen in any other supernova so far in the nearby universe, in the nearby 100 megaparsec sample. Okay, the first hint of supernova associated with GRB came with 980326, and you see that in fact what's shown here is the R magnitude versus time, and the measurements are few shown here with in circles, and there's one spectroscopic point here, which in fact showed it is a very red object, but otherwise it's all red magnitude, roughly like a new to the minus 3 sort of a spectrum. And the excess here with respect to the afterglow, it was tremendous at about 20 days. And these are various supernova light curves. Because the redshift of this object is not known, it's hard to say what it is, but if you believe it's a supernova, then the redshift would be of the order of 1. And it would be a supernova like BW in brightness. Actually, the very first GRB for which optical afterglow was detected, in retrospect, here's a spectrum taken, or reconstructed a few days after the event, and you can see, in fact, it has this sort of a thing where there's as you go to higher frequencies, in fact, there's the sharp roll-off, which is very characteristic of supernovae. Basically, below about 4,000 angstroms, the resonant lines of metals are so strong that there's essentially line blanketing, and this is a very characteristic supernova sort of a spectrum. And again, it is similarly a bright supernova. But the direct proof that, in fact, these are supernovae came with a study of GRB 030329 detected with the HEDI satellite. And there are spectra from several observatories shown here. And in fact, we can see that spectra are very detailed, or at least for this sort of a game, and in fact show that the idea that this is a object with 1C spectrum is in fact correct. So between 98BW and 0329, you now have a 1C spectra associated with an unusual nearby low luminosity GRB and a 1C spectrum associated with the typical cosmological GRB. There's nothing too special about 030329 to say it's something atypical. It's nearby, which of course is a selection effect. It is far away, you won't get this sort of spectra. Okay, the reason I'm showing some of this is discussions with some of my colleagues in the last few weeks. A lot of them sort of focus on the spectroscopic thing, saying that's the real proof. Yeah, well, that's the real proof, but in order to get this sort of spectra, you must be very lucky. Namely, you must get a low redshift object with a faint host, preferably, and a rapid decay of the afterglow. And nature is usually not so kind. So you have to rely on what you get. And the main thing you can do is HST monitoring in various bands. So here, like four bands. And these are fitted with genuine model curves where you just take, for example, BW as a template, stretch it, and because of redshift, and you get a pretty good fit, as well as in both spectrally and time-wise. So this is another example of a supernova. It would be very hard, with even with the largest telescopes, to get a spectrum at this because the two conditions I told you, three conditions are not satisfied. The host is reasonably bright, the afterglow doesn't have a jet break early on, and the redshift isn't very low. Okay, do you always find one? No. Here's an HST sensitive search taken, and it's a little busy diagram. These are the actual measurements. And what's shown here is a 94i, which is sort of a standard 1C spectra template taken here, which this is to show that the measurements can be bracketed between, you know, a BW, which we certainly can exclude at the redshift of the GRB, and 94i. It can be a little bit brighter than that, but fainter than BW. So not always supernovae are bright. Okay, well, X-ray flashes are, a couple years ago, they were like the rage. So they're not so much the rage right now, but I don't know whether it's a different phenomena or not, but if you plot a new FNIR for GRB, and here's a very typical GRB, 99123, it peaks at about an MeV. In contrast, an X-ray flash peaks at low energies, in this case at about 20 kV, and there's some which even peak at 2 kV, which is very interesting. Now, whether these sorts of GRBs have been detected preferentially by BATC because of its response just being harder is still amazingly a matter of debate. Nonetheless, the question is, what are these objects? One idea is these are GRBs which are beamed off axis. At least in a couple of cases, we have a reasonably what this is that, in fact, in one case, we know that redshift is 0.251, which is pretty low in the GRB game. That's almost like the closest sort of a GRB. And there's no evidence for off-axis model, and I won't go into this. So let's say there's a GRB that is beamed in that direction at high Lorentz factor. Then as the shock slows down, the Lorentz factor decreases, and then the aberration cones open up, and therefore even you, who are 90 degrees, at some point should start seeing this emission, and therefore you should see a rise in the afterglow, which is not seen. So I've got to say something here, a little bit of sociology. As some of you know, I always like to make fun of ourselves, because many scientists, I think, take their work seriously, which is always a puzzle to me, which is when quasars were discovered, there's this huge move to unify quasars. Everything was just a question of orientation. Quasar is a fixed thing. It's got narrow, broad line regions, narrow line regions, got jets. And if you look one way, it's a type 1, the other way, it's type 2, then so on. But we know. It's a very simple lesson we can learn from that, which is this unification stuff is a good idea. But it's an idea that, if you take it seriously, is a very bad idea, because quasars cannot be unified with this simple model. There are quasars and quasars, and this physics is very dirty. There's a huge luminosity function, and so to shoehorn your expectation into a single model is a good mental thing, but you should never take it seriously. So the unification pundits here, I think, should learn a little bit from history, and I don't think you're going to unify GRBs by orientation angles at all. Okay. So, the associated supernovae summary. So, as I said, when conditions are propitious, low redshift, faint host galaxy, early jet break, you always found a supernova. Or in the couple of cases where it hasn't been found, the limits are not extraordinary, like not minus 10 magnitude, which would be extraordinary for a supernova in my mind. For what it's worth, the supernovae where which are well studied, by which I mean these are the nearest ones, they all have 1C. And there is a result, which is that the supernova O2-1211 appears to be an ordinary 1C as opposed to these which have broad lines. However, and this there's no question in my mind at all, there's no doubt, there's a large spread in this in the peak magnitudes. They're not hypernova if your condition for hypernova is a peak magnitude of minus 19 or so. Okay, so Alicia Soderberg has put this together. Its paper is available in AstroPH, or maybe even published at this point, which is you sort of go through the literature and say, okay, what are the ones that are believable bumps? Because you have to, this is an exercise to not all data perfect. You find that, in fact, the red histograms here, and this is peak magnitude, and the red histograms are either associated with GRB or X-ray flashes. And there are some which are bright, but there are some in the local sample which are even brighter. And if you just do a KS test, which you don't need to do, you can look at this and say they're indistinguishable. Okay, but some people like doing this sort of statistics, and you can, the answer is they're indistinguishable. So it's not like the peak magnitude of these two things are different. Okay, so that certainly should give a pause. Towards the end, I'll end my talk on a little bit more of sociology and religion. Okay, so this is a movie. This is leading up to this. This was it's outsourced to Bollywood, and along with the general trend in our country, it is it's a general propaganda that we like to do here, actually. Okay, it's a very high resolution simulation, actually. Core collapsing, black hole is forming, jets stream out, burrow their way through the star, and unfortunately we sort of really couldn't get the sound effects. Boom! Well, boom, there, okay. It comes out, jets streaming at you, and if you're on axis, it'll be a blinding GRB. Okay. Well, there's some still theoretical work need to sort of go from here. The energy distribution. Energy is traced, as I said, in four different ways. Just from photon-photon opacity considerations, you know that the gamma rays must be tracing Lorentz factor of 100 or so, typically. The early afterglow is tracing Lorentz factor of 10, and the radio Lorentz factor of a few, and the supernova Lorentz factor of 1.005, which is 0.1c. Okay, well, what's the situation? If you want to understand this particular division of energy, which I would say is a very important part, and just to focus on the supernova, which is sort of, you know, large cottage industry, especially in this room, I think it's sort of missing the big boat, actually. And in this particular case, 030329, well-studied supernova, all that stuff has. It turns out most of the energy in this particular thing, in fact, is exhibited in the radio afterglow. In fact, this is not a GRB at all. It's a radio burst of something. In the sense, if you want to observationally characterize where is the energy, it's not in gamma rays. Okay, so that brings to the point, well, how about 980425? An absolute favorite model, and I'm sure we'll hear it endlessly over the next 5 days, is this off-axis paradigm. That these are all the same. There's a viewing angle, theta. There's an opening angle, theta naught. And if you're away from that, it's an off-axis explosion. You see little GRBs, you may see more X-rays, you may see nothing, but eventually it's all the same thing. 0425 has been modeled by so many people that's an off-axis thing. Well, if it is off-axis, it's very, very clever. It is 6 years later, it is showing no signs of being off-axis at all. That is, if it is off-axis, at some point, the emitting material cannot have the aberration cones always. Material will emit isotropically, and you should see, and Alicia has shown, in fact, that there's no evidence to believe. A single injection of energy at early times with a few episodes very early on is enough to explain the data. Okay, so I think we should start thinking of these explosions in a slightly more sophisticated way. Where is the highest Lorentz factor stuff coming? Where is at a Lorentz factor of 10 coming? And you can see I've labeled here four of these, which are the nearest ones, they have names. It's not that I just took the all the nearest ones have labels. And you can see, in fact, they are unenergetic and they're peculiar in some way. And this is should absolutely not surprise any of us. It's just like quasars. The first 3C, whatever sources that are high ratio, you know, ratios of a few tens. But, you know, a thing like our Milky Way, black hole, it's puny. There are other few nearby AGN. They're very, very tiny compared to the sample. And that's exactly what we're seeing, is that the cosmological ones give us a very different view. But closer you come in, you find that these are very lower energy and somewhat more complex machines than we think. Okay, I'd summarized this earlier, so I'd like to wrap up here with my... So this room has a bunch of desperately seeking astronomers. You know, zealotry has become a big thing in, you know, you make a cartoon, you get almost a fatwa issued against you. Sort of almost a similar thing is getting on here, which I call as collapse of zealotry. And it has gained adherence across the world, especially in the Chinchin and Kampai regions. Now, I don't know how many of you know what a Chinchin and a Kampai region is. What's that? Okay. So, the fact that Italian colleagues spoke up at least identifies one of the countries. What are these astronomers desperately seeking? They're desperately seeking for low metal galaxies. You'll see papers, oh, you know, this galaxy is low metal city. If you read the literature and sort of look at slightly critically without this bias, there's no reason to believe any of this stuff at all. It may be true, but not with the current data. The other group, they're desperately over-interpreting polarization study. They say, oh my God, this 1BC is polarized. Well, 1As are also polarized. Any damn explosion is polarized because it's not a perfect spherical thing as in a computer. So the question is this extraordinarily polarized? And the desperately over-interpreting astronomers won't answer that. And finally, the most desperate are what I call as the supernova weather people. They look, this line, you know, whatever, this silicon blah line, came on day 3 on that particular burst. And look at this, it also came on a Tuesday, and therefore it must be very meaningful. Okay. So, the thing is that at some point, these things should do something extraordinary. GRBs are not some minor silicon line coming on day 3. It's pretty obvious when you hit by a GRB, you get very bright afterglow if you survive that. So you're not looking for something minor here at all. Okay, so I think supernova weather people should rise above the cloud layer. Okay, so along this party line, here's, I'm absolutely going to protect the guilty here. I won't tell you the first authors of this paper. 2001 EM claimed to be a fantastic hypernova 1BC. Well, here's a paper in response to that, which in fact the authors then go and say, if it's a hypernova expanding at this relativistic speed, you could actually see a VLBI. You know, and this has nothing to do with how much circumstellar density is. In fact, lower the circumstellar density, the better, because the shockwave doesn't get slowed down. Nothing. The speed limit is 20,000 kilometers per second. But this was even better. There are at least 4 papers titled Hypernova, Highly Asymmetric Explosion, Incredibly Polarized, whatever. And so, this was a little clever title, I thought. We said radio evolution of the ordinary. I think we should have italicized this, but I guess Aperture doesn't allow that. And you can see, it couldn't be like a bunch of nuts. We have, you know, one of the most distinguished astronomers who is on our paper here. Okay, so let me end. I think this is what we understand about these explosions. Okay, thanks.
Were much lower luminosity than the cosmological ones.
Yeah.
And now suppose that the cosmological ones have a distribution function that tails off to low energy. Would we have missed them all? Can you make a distribution function that will really favor and give you 3 or 4 at low redshift and none at high redshift? And what would that distribution function look like?
Okay, this sort of statistics, as you well know, is hardly my strength, so I would not be the person to answer. I will simply tell you, I can look at quasars and give exactly that. There, the number density of intrinsically subluminous quasars in any band you look is very high locally. And yet, when I look at the 3C catalog, I pick out the very distant ones. So my view is that if the luminosity function is truly very broad, okay, then there's existence proof that you, depending on how you sense them, you know, you can get either the cosmological ones, or if you sense it at a very different sensitivity, you get the local ones. So I was really hoping with Swift, you know, the proof of this would have been if you reduce the flux sensitivity, log n log s, at some point log n log s should become s2 minus 3 by 2 in this picture, okay? And the real worry is, why aren't we seeing that? Because no one is claiming s2 minus 3 by 2 for any sample right now. Whereas in the radio, we can take the 3C sample, and then we can take the nearby 5 giga sample, and we'll see a very different, you know. But again, the spread is very large. Problem here is that we have only one nearby one despite three missions. And with Swift, the whole idea was it will be five times more sensitive than BAT-C, and boy, every day we'll be getting a 98 BW. Not true. It's only 200 times more sensitive than BAT-C, and that's not good enough. So the proof for what you're seeking, I would say, is maybe we need to go 10 times more sensitive or something bigger, and then this population should pop up. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense to me.
Well, I guess I have to make is two comments on bumps and wiggles from a desperate astronomer. 98 BW, as a supernova, there is no doubt there is seen off axis. Whatever the GRB was, I do not care, but the supernova was certainly about 20 degrees off some polar axis. We see this in the spectra. O2 AP, ordinary, well, there are maybe 10% of all 1Cs that have lines as broad as that. That may still make it ordinary, but, you know, not in my opinion. Okay.
I'm not denying that these explosions are non-spherical at all. In fact, that is perhaps the miss. That is, in fact, where the supernova modeling has had traditional difficulties, that spherically symmetric models have had a hard time, in fact, exploding. So there's no question that these things are asymmetrical. But asymmetrical is not equal to GRB at all. That's a huge jump from there to GRBs. GRBs are incredibly asymmetrical. Their opening angles are a degree, few degrees. If you make any supernova that, I would say, okay, now you're in the, now we can talk business. 20 degrees, that's for the birds.
Shri, could you say a few words more about the radio emission of O3 O329?
Yeah.
It was it as strong intrinsically as 1998 BW?
Alicia, do you know? Alicia.
Factor of 100 brighter.
Yeah, Alicia will be showing the luminosity functions of ordinary supernovae, BW, and the GRBs. And BW sits right in between.
But I remember that you had this paper that the radio afterglow of 1998 BW was so enormous. But
enormous to the supernova sample. So what I'm saying is,
okay,
there's a supernova sample luminosity function. 98 BW is at the high end of supernova and low end of the GRB.
But then this one is at the super high end, then, what you would say.
No. This is a GRB. It is, as Alicia said, it's 100 times
bright. It's the GRB radio. It's not the supernova.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ah, okay. Makes a difference.
Just a comment. The characteristic of the hypernova is not really brightness, because it's determined by the nuclear mass ejected, and which depends very strongly on the fallback, even in the case of the aspherical explosion. And also the high end might be contaminated by the circumstellar interaction, like 99S. And so we should use more the spectra broadness to estimate the energy of the explosion. So that is more kind of defining things. That's my opinion. So it's brightness is a bit misleading, but it's interesting too. It's distributed in the same way, yes. And also the brightness depends on the fallback, means it depends on the neutrons, the black hole, case. And even the neutron star case has no the in fallback, so that could be even brighter than the black hole case.
Well, I thought the idea for 1C is not only there's no hydrogen, but there's no helium also. Maybe wrong, but there are a number of... Well, Paulo is the expert on this. Oh, it's okay, you can... No, go ahead.
The microphone's almost counter to the discussion. I'm not quite sure how you did it.
Yeah, so hydrogen we can rule out almost completely. As far as helium, there has been some claims for the presence of helium in 98 BW. I think if you look at the far infrared spectra, they would show that this is not confirmed, meaning that one micron line is there, but the corresponding 2 micron line, which is expected to be there, is not. So I think the upper limit on the helium mass is of the order of a few tenths, perhaps. A few tenths of a solar mass. Yeah.
Why do you shout?
Yeah, just
I'll repeat the question. Yes.
So my question is, what would be the lowest knowledge factor of the literature for the object which is really called the GRP, but the knowledge factor is what does that have?
Yeah, so the two...
So it's about bringing those two phenomena.
Yeah. Yeah, so, this is a slight, it's a theoretical argument, which is basically the Lorentz factor constraint, the minimum constraint comes from saying, I have here stuff above 511 keV, and in a certain time scale, and therefore region, and the photon-photon opacity of the is should, in fact, be less than unity, and that sets the limit for GRBs. But with an X-ray flash, for example, this one, technically, there's no constraint in the sense we don't detect any photons. You know, you start this exercise by saying, you know, E1 and E2, and E1 times E2 should be greater than MEC squared. So I can take a photon here, and I do need a high-energy photon. If I don't have that, there is no constraint. So from a simple argument, the XRFs need not be ultra-relativistic. But there are experts here like Peter Masharos who can... perhaps give a stronger thing. But from a simple idea, XRFs are 2 kV. There's absolutely no reason they should be relativistic in the sense of 100. So I don't know whether it should be 10 or something. That argument, I don't know. Yeah. So you can say maybe 100 for GRBs, order 10 for XRFs, and then some... But the XRF phenomena in the optical sense turns out to be not too different. You know, it's got... Well, there's some technical issues about exactly, first of all, what we mean by XRF. It's sort of been a little changing definition. But the detectors on SWIFT basically absorb below about 15 kV. There's no response. So if you want to get sort of the really nice XRFs, like the 2 kV one, you know, it's still heady. And heady has got a pretty slow rate. SWIFT is unlikely to change this, and I don't know why, but all the SWIFT things, some they get relabeled as X-ray rich GRBs. I don't know whether that's just a sociological thing or a real thing.
The idea of on axis radiation in relativistic outflow is based on assumption that you have isotropic distribution of particles in the frame of the jet. If you have an isotropic distribution of particles, in fact, you could expect also off-axis emission. Is this considered seriously in this discussions? Because it's a priori assumes isotropic distribution of particles in the frame of the jet.
Yeah, that's what the standard afterglow models are.
Could be. There could be situation when you could have an isotropic distribution in frame of the jet. Then you could expect different pattern, different energies, and you could even expect the off-axis emission.
Oops. On that note.
I would like to comment on the on your remark that finally you should see the radio because it's become spherical. I think it's oversimplification. When it's relativistic, you have both, you have collimation, which give you a Doppler factor squared, and a boosting, which give you a Doppler factor cube, which amplified the radio signal as well. So it is true that in principle it becomes spherical symmetric, but when it becomes spherical symmetric, you lose a normal factor, and simply the intensity is below detection for normal, for very late time when it becomes spherical symmetric. Not according to the leaves, but finally it will become spherical symmetric, but then the intensity will be too low for a normal GRB to be detected.
Yeah, this transition when the afterglow becomes from relativistic to now, to becomes in fact transrelativistic, is seen that you can in fact for three or four GRBs which are well studied for years because their signal is bright, in fact you see where you have some idea what the energy release is based on afterglow modeling, and you see in fact there's a break as this particular thing that you're addressing does take place. So I think we a year later, there's no reason to believe these are relativistic at all. So in fact, some of the work that's related to this is done by Galliam and collaborators, which in fact put the best limits really old radio afterglows. Right now, they're not constraining in terms of the number of axes. It's all consistent with what we know.
Well, of course, I agree that if you interpret the data the way that they interpret the data, it's consistent with what you're saying. But we know when we see radio, which is symmetrical, actually from supernova, we see radio signals from normal supernova, which are not associated or maybe associated, but we don't see their GRBs. So if you just take this as calibration of non-relativistic radio signal, then still this is a long way to go down. I mean, you won't see a radio emission from a supernova at a redshift of a fraction of even one. So very, very nearby supernova, you'll see
radio. It's very simple. The energy in the particles in a supernova is much.
No, the
tiny.
kinetic energy.
I'm just saying I do an equipartition analysis based on the radio data for supernovae, and say how much energy there is. 10 to the 45 ergs for a supernova is an impressive number. 47 would almost make it absolutely unique.